From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's a new breed of criminal, the computer outlaw. These brilliant outlaws can break into government and business computer networks and wreak havoc. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the authors of a new book about computer crime and the new legal and ethical questions it raises. Also, a life in jazz that started as a life in the military. Willie Ruff tells us how he joined the segregated army at age 14 and learned to play the French horn. And commentator David Gurevich wonders why the U.S. media is still so fascinated with every move made by Mikhail Gorbachev. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that it's time to start negotiations with the Arab states, but he also repeated some of Israel's main conditions for talks. Shamir said he would not negotiate with Palestinians from East Jerusalem, and he rejected any territorial compromise over the Golan Heights. The prime minister has come under fire from right-wingers who've threatened to quit his cabinet if he accepts a U.S. plan for peace negotiations with the Palestinians and the Arab states. In a television interview today, though, he seemed to hint that Israel's position could change. Relief officials in northern Iraq are worried that another Kurdish refugee crisis could develop. An estimated 40,000 Kurds have fled the city of Sulaymaniyah since fighting broke out in the region a week ago. NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
There has been a steady stream of trucks and taxis and tractors taking refugees out of the city in recent days. They're piled high with food and blankets and other provisions. The refugees are heading to the Iranian border, where tens of thousands of refugees from the last round of fighting are still squatting in makeshift camps. Many of the refugees say they're fleeing because they fear the Iraqis will launch another attack on the city. Fighting broke out last Thursday when Iraqi soldiers reportedly shot and killed two Peshmerga rebels. The rebels then clashed with Iraqi troops and tanks in the city center. An estimated 600 people were killed or wounded. 150 people are still hospitalized. Today, 1 week later, the city is calm. Peshmerga rebels are in virtual control, although Kurdish leaders are negotiating with Iraqi officials to jointly govern the city. I'm Deborah Wong in Sulaymaniyah.
Reports in South Africa named four more black political institutions that allegedly received covert government funds. From Johannesburg, NPR's John Madison reports.
It was another day of damage control in the South African political crisis over covert government funding of political institutions. Foreign Minister Pik Botha briefed diplomats today to assure them that the government is no longer funding the Inkatha Freedom Party, whose leader is Zulu Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. Buthelezi's Inkatha handed the government a check for nearly $100,000 today as a refund of the government's funding for Inkatha political rallies. But the Johannesburg Star reported that at least four more black political institutions were paid. Several of the alleged recipients of the money were politicians without demonstrated support who regularly attend meetings and conferences to attack officials of the African National Congress. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Stock prices were down today on Wall Street after the government reported an unexpected decrease in orders for durable goods. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 17 points to close at 2,966.23. Declines led advances by a narrow margin in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The federal agency that insures private pensions said today that its own liabilities are growing. The Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation is a wholly owned government company that protects pension funds, much as the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation protects bank deposits. Agency officials told Congress today that the bankruptcies of a number of major corporations have doubled its liabilities to $5 billion. The agency's director, James Lockhart, said that figure could rise to as much as $11 billion in the next 10 years. The nation's space agency said today that it will be at least a week before another shuttle launch attempt can be made. This morning's planned launch was called off because of a computer failure. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The problem is with a computer controller located within the shuttle's main engines. The controller regulates various functions on those main engines, and a glitch makes it impossible to fly. The shuttle is being prepared for extensive work tomorrow when engineers will begin changing out the faulty hardware. NASA says it will take at least 7 to 10 days to make repairs. Today's scrub comes as Vice President Dan Quayle, the head of the National Space Council, announced that the U.S. will no longer build new space shuttles. Speaking to an audience at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, Quayle said that the nation will instead concentrate on new technology to succeed the shuttle program. NASA had asked to buy a new $2 billion orbiter during the next fiscal year, but was turned down. Vice President Quayle says the next phase of launch vehicles could cost as much as $11.5 billion. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Astronomers in England said today that they've identified the first new planet ever found outside the solar system. The group used a radio telescope to locate the apparent planet, which orbits a very dense star and appears to be about 12 times as massive as Earth. Scientists say they detected the planet by analyzing variations in radio waves. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, you caught us. Today is the second day this week we're not presenting the interview we promoed. But we expect to bring you the interviews on the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship and neighborhood crime watch groups later this week. For today, we have the story of high-tech crime, computer crime. The government, the military, the phone system, the banks, nearly every kind of business relies on computer networks. If you have a computer, a telephone, and a connecting device called a modem, you can join a number of computer networks. If you're a brilliant computer outlaw, you can break into closed networks and get secret information, or scramble the information, or even shut down the system. And that can be a big problem for business and government. My guests John Markoff and Katie Hafner are the authors of the new book Cyberpunk: Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. Markoff writes about computers for the New York Times. Hafner has written about them for Data Communications and Business Week. They found that as computer crime has become more of a problem, the public image of the hacker has changed.
Well, it's partially a question of semantics and partially a question of two separate generations. The word hacker has changed its meaning in the public eye over the last 20 years. When the term was first used with respect to computers, it was used to refer to a group of people largely at MIT originally who were obsessed with programming and designing computers. And the label hacker was a very positive term. It was something to be proud of. And it was a very small insular community. And then, around 1983 in particular, with the advent of the movie War Games, the word hacker took on a new meaning. It began to refer to largely young men who broke into computers. And I think that that is the term that's come to come to the popular mind now. And the old term is now largely lost.
And we tried to be very sensitive about the way we use the word in the book. Because we know that there's a huge community out there who take offense at the use of the word hacker to mean something negative.
Give us a sense of what kinds of crimes we're talking about. Maybe we can use a couple of examples from your book here. Kevin Mitnick, what is the crime he was found guilty of?
Well, Kevin started out as a phone freak in the late 70s and early 80s, and his crime back then was your basic wire fraud, actually, stealing telephone service. And then he graduated onto computers, but always refining his telephone, his phone freaking skills, if you will. And by the time he got arrested for the last time, well, we hope it's the last time, in 1988, he had evolved into a very sophisticated computer criminal where he was actually breaking into computers at the site of Digital Equipment Corporation in New Hampshire, where software was being developed and designed, which was actually quite a feat.
I think some of our listeners will remember the story of Robert Tappan Morris, and he's one of the people who you write about in your book Cyberpunk. And our listeners might remember that he was a Cornell graduate student at the time, and his father was a computer security researcher with the National Security Agency. It's very embarrassing for the family. So what did he do? What kind of computer crime was he found guilty of?
Well, Robert wrote a program that was designed to secretly copy itself through a huge collection of computer networks called the Internet. largely used by academic researchers and corporate researchers in the military. He made a small programming error. His stunt was intended to be sort of a Kilroy was there. He wanted his program to secretly take up residence in thousands of computers. It wasn't designed to do anything except to live. He made a small programming error, which caused his program in sort of a sorcerer's apprentice style to run wildly out of control. And what happened was is that hundreds and thousands of copies of his programs ended up on each computer, and the computers just bogged down under the load. And computer scientists and system managers all over the country spent days and weeks sort of cleaning up the mess that his little secret program had left.
Now, you describe your book as being about the social consequences of computer networks. I guess what makes networks so potentially vulnerable is that if you get into the system, there's thousands of computers that can be affected, and also, well, really important information that can be totally rearranged or stolen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
What are some of the things that a good computer criminal can do to an information system?
Well, first thing we have to say is that we're not advocating any of this, and the book is not...
you wrote a how-to guide.
The book is definitely not a how-to guide. We were trying to describe a culture, and we were trying to get into these people's heads and sort of see how they thought and how they acted. But to the extent that a corporation keeps, for example, its business activities on a computer or in a computer network, if that network is accessible from the outside, the information there, in whatever detail, is vulnerable. Kevin Mitnick had a real talent for going into a computer, looking to see who used the computer, understanding where they sat in the organization. For example, he could tell the people who were the decision makers. And then if you have what's thought of generally as super user status on a particular computer, you can do anything with the information on that machine. And he would get super user status on a particular computer, and then he would be able to read electronic mail. And I don't know if you've ever used an electronic mail system. People tend to be very open and frank with the things they send on in electronic messages, and you can glean a tremendous amount of information. Not only can you get at the information, but you can direct the power of the computer to scanning through it.
And Kevin wasn't reading just any electronic mail. He was actually reading the electronic mail that the security people who were trying to catch him were passing back and forth about the chase.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about computer crime with Katie Hafner and John Markoff, authors of the new book, Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers and the Computer Frontier. What kinds of security systems are there to protect a network from an invader?
Probably the best sort of first defense is to actually encrypt information. That is, to run it through an algorithm so that anybody who sees the information in between you and the person you're intending for it to reach sees just gibberish. And encryption is becoming much more widely used in commercial systems. It's a good first line of defense, but it's not insurmountable.
One of the observations you've made is that the weakest link in computer security is the human link, and that you've come across a lot of computer criminals who've gotten ID numbers and gotten passwords by impersonating the boss.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kevin's big skill was
This is Kevin Mitnick.
Kevin Mitnick, right. He was this phenomenon called social engineering. Another character calls it psychological subversion, where he could, for instance, talk anybody out of anything. He had a tremendous ability to gain people's trust, to get an operator at the phone company, for instance, just to be willing after a while to give up her or his life to Kevin, any information, whatever, that Kevin wanted by the end of an hour on the telephone, he had pretty much gotten.
But one of the things he would do would be to pretend to be the boss or the boss's secretary.
That's right.
And just be outraged when they wouldn't give him the information that he needed.
Right. In fact, we have a woman in the book named Susan Thunder who she was flown to Washington at one point, and she was told that she had X number of minutes to hack her way into a classified military computer, and she did it basically using what she called psychological subversion. She posed as a colonel or a major, and then pulled rank and got the person on the phone very scared to the point where they gave her the password.
What are federal and state agents trying to do to crack down on computer crime now?
A lot. We sort of are, well, I'm of the opinion that in some ways the law enforcement community has overreacted. There was a prosecutor at one point who said that a teenager with a modem was as dangerous as a teenager with a handgun, which I believe is a slight overreaction. There's a lot going on right now. For instance, the FBI, the training school in Quantico has a computer, a course now in how to investigate a computer crime, which is a different way of approaching the investigation of a crime than your basic homicide. And the entire law enforcement community is much more aware than it was even 2 or 3 years ago.
In the last year and a half, there's been a national crackdown that was widely known as Operation Sundevil, in which there were a number of arrests and even larger number of searches in 14 or 15 different states, led by both federal investigators, the Secret Service, telephone companies. Most of the people that they searched and or arrested were young kids who I think would fall into this category that we've tried to describe, not people who are out to make a profit, not people who are motivated by greed, but people who were interested in the adventure that they thought they could get from wandering around in these large networks of computers.
That's right. What motivates these people is very different from what motivates someone to, say, rob a convenience store. It's this thrill of electronic exploration, and some of them are aware that they're breaking the law, and some of them aren't, and those who are aware that they're breaking the law, it doesn't matter, but the question now is does this make them criminals in kind of a classic sense? It's a very difficult question that we're just beginning to start to answer with a whole new body of laws.
Well, Robert Tappan Morris was the first person convicted by a jury under a fairly new law. This is the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986. What is the act and what does it represent in terms of, like, new laws to regulate computer crime?
Well, this is an attempt to make what in the past has been tampering with computers over networks against the law. We're seeing...
Was it not against the law before that?
In many states, there has been, and nationally, there was no particular... There were wire fraud statutes, but there were no computer crime laws because there were no computers where valuable information was stored. But the world has changed, and the laws are only now catching up.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about computer crime, and my guests are Katie Hafner and John Markoff, co-authors of the new book Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about computer crime with John Markoff, who reports on computers for the New York Times, and Katie Hafner, who's former news editor of Data Communications magazine and also wrote about computers for Business Week. They've co-authored a new book about computer crime called Cyberpunk. What are some of the difficulties of prosecuting computer crime?
Well, evidence is a very ephemeral thing in a digital world. I mean, computer criminals don't leave fingerprints. And so just finding the criminal, tracing an individual who may have broken into a computer at a large corporation back through a web of networks is an almost impossible task. And really, if someone is good, adept, it is an impossible task. In the case of both the Germans and Kevin Mitnick, betrayal was a big factor. getting caught.
Digital equipment, in fact, had not caught Kevin after a full year of trying to figure out who was breaking into their computers. And the only way he got caught was that his best friend, who was in on it with him, got sick and tired of it and turned him in.
Since it seems more and more people are breaking into computer networks, is that causing some companies or some security systems to keep things on paper or in some other form of filing other than the computer?
Well, there's a simple way to, it doesn't necessarily have to be on paper. You just have to disconnect your computer from the network. And as long as there's an air gap around it, no one is going to break into it electronically.
An air gap meaning it's not connected by phone or wire to another computer?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, that's what the military does with their classified networks. Most classified information is kept on computer systems that have no access to the outside world, which is the sort of the flaw in the war game scenario, if you will, is that nobody's going to be able to dial up World War III. And I don't think people are backing away from it, but I think people are slow to move their paper information to computers because they're concerned about things like this. And in some cases, rightfully so.
Are there concerns that in the efforts to crack down on computer crime, there will be civil liberties violations of law-abiding computer users?
Well, absolutely. In fact, it's a huge issue right now, at least in a certain circle, of civil libertarians who are quite concerned about this.
What are the violations that people are concerned about on the civil liberties front?
Well, one of the classic ones at a game company in Texas, when the Secret Service agents came in as part of a search, they literally confiscated all of the computer equipment and related software materials at the company, and they kept them. And in fact, there was the Secret Service was looking for the material related to the activities of one employee of the company, but they almost drove the company out of business by not returning the materials. The company really couldn't proceed with its business because everything that it relied on was gone.
And that's happened in a lot of these cases where computers are seized and practically everything is seized that looks vaguely electronic. Telephone answering machines have been seized lots and lots of floppy disks, and the people who've had these searches done never see them again.
Well, it's a tremendous challenge for the law enforcement community too. Imagine the problem if you are looking for somebody's electronic mail and it's stored on a large computer which has the mail of thousands of other people. If you're a law enforcement person going through that, how do you separate out the information you can look at from the information you can't look at?
So you think that there's probably new codes of ethics and new laws that are going to have to be created to deal with the new dilemmas that are arising?
on both sides. I mean, I think one of the things that's missing is the sort of the teaching of computer ethics or, if you will, computer citizenship. Most parents whose kids break into systems have no idea that it's even possible to do something. They're still more concerned about the kids. I mean, they think it's great that the kids aren't on the streets, right?
And a lot of
right, and the kid might be at home trying to break into
somebody's right.
system.
Well, and the parents see this. They see the kid up in the bedroom in front of the computer, and they think, oh, how nice. Everyone values computer literacy, but we don't really think about the negative consequences of computer literacy.
John, someone once called the New York Times to confess about a computer crime they'd committed. Had they called you?
They actually called the national desk of the paper, and the call was routed to me.
What did they have to say?
Well, people tend to brag about their ability, and since I've written widely about the subject, and people have seen the articles, they'll call and say, I've done this, I've done that. It doesn't happen every week, but it happens 3 or 4 times a year.
Oh, that happens that often. So what do people confess to when they call you?
Well, they tell me I've been able to get into military computers. I've seen...
that they've been able to get into... Not that you...
They've said that they've been able to get into military computers and that they've been able to see military information that is actually very surprising. And I'll ask them, well, let me see it. And oftentimes it's simply bragging. I mean, I think that there's a lot of folklore out there, and some of it sort of rubs off. There's a mystique around computer crime at this point, and you have to be very careful.
A lot of hackers, they love to strut and brag and boast, and sometimes it takes some investigating to bring them back down to reality.
So, John, did you ever write about anybody who called you like that?
I have a number of times. I mean, well, someone called with respect to Robert Morris, which was what led me to identify Robert.
Broke the story?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the story is that someone called the National Desk and said, I know the person who did this. And they were referred to me, and we had several conversations. And at one point, the person who called me slipped, and he was referring to Mr. X as the author of this program. And instead of Mr. X, he said RTM. And I know enough about the computer world to realize that RTM was probably a computer login. And so I called a friend at Harvard University, and I said, run this program called Finger on the three letters RTM. And he did that on a Unix computer up there, and back came the name Robert Tappan Morris. And that gave me a phone number in Cornell, which I called, and nobody was there. And so I couldn't do much with the name. But then the next day, I had called the National Security Agency to ask them what was going on, and I got a call back from them, and I said, I think I know who did it. And the person who called me back said, who did it? And I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. You're the computer police. We began to have this discussion, and it finally became apparent to me that the person I was talking to knew more about the case than I did. And I thought, well, that's kind of peculiar. This has only happened 48 hours ago. How is it they know so much? And I finally said, well, I think that the person who did it was Robert Tappan Morris. And he said, you're right. And we talked for a while longer, and I was about to hang up. And I finally said, well, it's peculiar. You have the same name as Robert Tappan Morris. And he said, well, it's not peculiar at all. It's my son.
Oh, no, that was the father that you were talking to.
That's right. That's right.
So the father basically had to track down the perpetrator, and it turned out to be his own son?
His son called him immediately after he realized what had gone wrong and said, look what I've done. And so he knew about it that way. They'd actually talked. By the time they talked to me, they'd actually already been in contact with the FBI.
So you became the first person to write about the story.
I was the person who identified him first, yeah.
Right. Such a remarkable story. Have you met Robert Tappan Morris? Interviewed him for the book?
Yeah, we know Robert well. We interviewed him for the book. We've spoken and visited with his parents, and we still stay in electronic contact with Robert.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about reporting the Robert section of the book is that a lot of people wanted to be interviewed electronically and not on the telephone or in person. Robert's former first girlfriend would only talk to us electronically because that's the way, I guess, she felt most comfortable about answering these questions, which is sort of one step removed from the telephone even.
So she'd be willing to type the answers into the computer, but she didn't want to talk to you.
That's right, and it was the same with Robert, too, that he just wanted to answer certain questions electronically, and it's difficult. You know, developing a phone rapport is one thing, and then developing this electronic rapport when you're interviewing someone is another plane entirely.
I guess one of the things that you're both trying to get at with this new book is how computers have given way to a whole new kind of obsessive person, kind of obsession.
It's more than an obsession. I mean, what we wanted to describe was this emerging electronic world, I mean, a community, if you will. And I think it's very difficult to understand this if you haven't participated in it. What we found is a person may live in an apartment complex, and he may have now, in this world that we're describing, more intimate relationships with someone who's a continent away than he does with his next-door neighbor. And that is a sense of community that people have difficulty understanding unless they've participated in that kind of community.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
And we've been talking about computer crime with Katie Hefner and John Markoff, co-authors of the new book Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier. And Markoff reports on computers for the New York Times. Katie Hefner is the former news editor of Data Communications and wrote about computers for Business Week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jazz French hornist Willie Ruff grew up in the segregated South and came of age in the segregated army. Now he teaches at Yale and performs around the world with his longtime musical partner, pianist Dwight Mitchell. Coming up, we talk with Ruff about his life and music. And Soviet emigre writer David Gurevich tells us why he doesn't jump every time Gorbachev makes a new announcement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Soviet Union, top communist officials have denounced a ban by Russian President Boris Yeltsin on political activity in the workplace. Party leaders have condemned the ban as not democratic and not constitutional. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin's ban forbids partisan activities at workplaces throughout Russia, the largest Soviet republic. Though it applies to all political movements, its most immediate effect would be to eliminate thousands of Communist Party cells, which operate in factories, farms, and government offices. Top party officials in the KGB and the Soviet Army today accused Yeltsin of trampling on their rights. They insisted that closing down communist cells within the military would undermine national defense. Party leaders called on Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, who is also the party's chief, to block Yeltsin's action. Gorbachev stayed out of the battle today, but the chairman of the Soviet Parliament promised an investigation of Yeltsin's decree. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Members of the Israeli cabinet say that they believe that there's been an understanding reached with U.S. officials over a Palestinian presence at proposed Middle Eastern peace talks. At the same time, Israeli Prime Minister Shamir challenged the Palestinians to enter peace talks on his terms or face the possibility of being excluded from the talks, and he also rejected any compromise on the Golan Heights. As for possible Israeli agreement, a State Department official says the first official word would probably come from Secretary of State Baker. In New York City, the Sanctions Committee at the UN met to talk about Iraq's request to sell oil to buy food and medicine. The committee has decided to refer the matter directly to the UN Security Council. Linda Fasulo has more on the story.
While there is agreement in the Sanctions Committee that Iraq's humanitarian needs should be met, there's disagreement on whether sanctions should be relaxed to allow a sale of oil. The U.S. and its allies don't want Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to profit politically from a sale, especially while Baghdad is in violation of ceasefire terms. And some diplomats say they want Iraq to use its gold and cash reserves to pay for humanitarian supplies. But so far, Baghdad has not specified how much gold it owns. It has told the United Nations that it has about $15 million in reserves, a number many diplomats say is far too low. Tomorrow, the Security Council is to meet in closed session to hear a report from the chairman of the Sanctions Committee. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 17 points to close at 2,966.23 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The government says that new orders for durable goods fell 1.6% last month, a reversal for economists who have said that the U.S. economy bottomed out in April and early May. At the same time, the Commerce Department revised its May report to show a rise of 2% in new orders instead of 3.4%. Gains in transportation orders in the month of June were not enough to offset declines in other areas. Two of the leaders of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue have been jailed by a federal court judge in Wichita, Kansas. Gordon Basham of member station KMUW reports.
Shaking his finger at Randall Terry and Pat Mahoney, federal judge Patrick Kelly ordered them into jail indefinitely after they refused to obey his order to stop blocking the entrance to a Wichita abortion clinic. Jim Evans, a third Operation Rescue official, was released by Kelly after he took a more moderate stance. Mahoney said the injunction won't stop the protests.
I don't think it'll impact Operation Rescue at all. We owe $500,000 in fines, and it's judicial tyranny.
Wichita police have arrested more than 500 protesters since Tuesday afternoon on misdemeanor charges connected with the demonstrations at three local abortion clinics. Violating the federal court order could result in fines of up to $25,000. For National Public Radio, I'm Gordon Basham in Wichita.
A group claiming to hold two kidnapped Germans in Lebanon says that they will be harmed unless there is information on the fate of two Lebanese prisoners in Germany. A statement to a Western news agency in Beirut gave a 48-hour time limit for Germany to provide information about the two German prisoners who have been charged with terrorism. Kuwait plans to export its first crude oil shipment this weekend since it was invaded by Iraq last August. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There aren't many French horn players in jazz. Willie Ruff is one of the better known. He was featured on the classic Miles Davis Gil Evans album Miles Ahead. Billy Strayhorn wrote a composition for Ruff, and he's performed around the world with his musical partner of many years, pianist Dwight Mitchell. The duo was the subject of a recent book by William Zinsser. Now Ruff has expanded on the story with his autobiography, A Call to Assembly. It tells the story of growing up in the segregated South, coming of age in the segregated army, going north to study at Yale, and years later returning to Yale as a teacher. Before we meet Ruff, let's listen to the Mitchell-Ruff duo playing Ill Wind from their new recording, Virtuoso Elegance in Jazz. Is really the story of a life, and I want to go back to what was quite a turning point in your young life, and that is when you were age 13 growing up in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Your mother died of tuberculosis.
Right.
Your father was already separated from your mother and living in another state. What did you think would become of you?
I had no idea, Terry, what would become of me. I was completely lost and had absolutely a lot of hope, but no direction, and it was only through music. Music was the agency that the music, and going into the military at 14 years old, like I did, was my deliverance.
Now, you enlisted when you were 14.
Right.
How did you forge the papers to get yourself in underage?
Well, I should explain that this was the military of 1946 was a very different military than we know now. It was completely and severely segregated. All blacks were off to themselves and had always been up to that point. So that I wanted to get into this situation of intense learning and intense possibilities for excellence that I had seen in all of these black military men who had gone on before me. And I knew at age 14 that if I could get myself into this group of Army, and especially the Air Force, the Tuskegee Airmen, to get among them, because these were the best educated young men in uniform in America, white or black at that time, you see. And I ended up on this all-black Air Force base commanded by a Colonel B.O. Davis, Jr., who became the first three-star black general. And it was there that I had all of my opportunities laid before me, shown how to pursue them, tutored by officers, officers' wives, older men, and got out of the Army at 17 and went directly to Yale as a freshman.
Didn't you look a little bit young at age 14? Did everybody get the point that you had forged your way into the military?
I'm sure they did. I looked like a Cub Scout, and I'm sure that also was a part of the great blessing. I was treated as a child. I was not pushed ahead of anything that was possible for me. I was chastised. I was disciplined the way parents discipline children. I was spanked and given beatings when I was bad. I couldn't use ugly words or smoke cigarettes or drink and go out with fast women. I had to wait till later.
So nobody ever tried to discover you and root you out?
Only one. My bandmaster, the first one, Mr. Ruffin, the ward officer, did, simply because he suspected I was too young. And he rode away for my birth certificate and confronted me with it. And I started to cry when he threatened to send me home. And he said I could relax because he had done the same thing. He joined when he was 16, and he had become a musician there, got all of his education through there, had the GI Bill, and continued his education. And so that confrontation was another great relief. He took that as an opportunity to step in and supervise my progress from there. And it was largely due to his efforts that I was able to get out when I got out in 1949 and go to Yale.
Huh. Now, you started playing the French horn while you were in the military.
That's right.
You had to talk your way into playing it, didn't they? Basically think it was too difficult an instrument.
That's right. I was a drummer when I went in, and there were much better drummers in the band, and it was soon apparent that I couldn't keep up. So they said, well, you got to go back to the infantry outfit. And this was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, 40 degrees below zero outside. And I said, I got to find something in this band that I can learn to play and learn it so I can stay here. And I spotted the French horn. I always loved the sound of it, but I knew how hard it was, and they fought against letting me learn to play it because nobody else there was playing it, and I knew they needed it, and if I got good enough on that, then I wouldn't be displaced again. I wouldn't be kicked out because nobody else was going to come around and play over my head.
Now, nobody wanted to teach you how to play it.
Well, nobody knew exactly, so I had to solicit help from other instrumentalists, baritone horn players and trombonists and clarinetists and flute players and all that. So I was kind of fumbling in the dark, but I was given great instructions on musicality, not technical aspects of the horn. I was taught how to tell a story with music.
Did you basically have to teach yourself from French horn books how to play, since
yes.
Nobody in the band knew how to play French horn or could teach you the technique?
Terry, that's exactly it. You hit it right on the head. I had to get a book and start from the beginning, and the book didn't have the fingerings in it. I had to sort of play that by ear, and I didn't know then that there were several possibilities, fingering possibilities for every note on the French horn, and I was choosing the ones that were flatter or sharper or not so well in tune. So by the time I taught myself how to play all the notes, very few of them were in tune.
So once you, was there a point where you had to relearn everything that you had learned?
Yes, indeed. I was. I fell into the hands of a fabulous teacher named Abe Quignaz in Columbus, Ohio, and he started me all over again, and that was a great blessing because suddenly the horn made sense. I could tell a story in tune.
When was the first time you heard how the French horn was really supposed to sound? I don't know if you'd been to symphonies before that or had classical records. And it's not the kind of music you can hear at the local club or at the bar. Yeah,
true. I heard it for the first time on records. But then I was attracted to that sound by the sound of a great contralto in my hometown of Sheffield, Alabama, named Miss Celia Appleton. And Miss Celia sounded like the French horn when she sang. And then I discovered that Marian Anderson also did. So these two reasons were enough for me to be so very strongly attracted to the sound of this instrument.
After you left the military, you ended up at Yale University.
Yes.
How did you get in? How did you know how to apply and where to apply to and all that? Were you helped at the military? Did they encourage you to do it?
Well, what happened, Terry, was that I read a jazz magazine in which there was an interview with the great Charlie Parker. And Charlie Parker was asked the question by the interviewer. He said, Bird, if you could do exactly what you wanted to do for the next several years with your musical life, what would you do? And Charlie Parker said, that's easy. He said, there's a little German cat teaching composition at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He said, I would enroll in school there and sit at Hindemith's feet and learn me some music. That was good enough for me. I didn't know Hindemith's name from anybody else's name. But I knew that if Charlie Parker wanted to study with him, that was very hip. So I asked around and found that indeed Hindemith was there. And I had relatives in New Haven. My sisters and brothers had moved there. So I applied and was given an audition. And the GI Bill took care of the whole thing, the whole undergraduate years and graduate school.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is musician Willie Ruff, who's probably best known for his jazz French horn playing and for his work with Dwight Mitchell and the Mitchell-Ruff duo. And Willie Ruff's just written a new autobiography, and we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Musician Willie Ruff is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called A Call to Assembly. You've played with the pianist Dwight Mitchell for how many years now? A long time.
36 years as a duo, and that's not even counting what the 3 years we were together in the Army.
Silly question, but what keeps you together? Few marriages last that long.
That's true. I think what keeps us together, the glue that binds, is the strength of our beginnings together in the military. We were taught by the same teachers at the same time. We were learning our craft together in a fabulously supportive environment as teenagers, and we can't get above it.
More than most jazz musicians, a lot of your career has not been in the clubs. It's been in the classroom. It's been abroad.
Yes.
Is that a direction that you chose?
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. We chose this direction early on in our careers. We wanted to have the concert stage. We wanted access to children's concerts. We wanted their ears. We wanted their minds. We wanted to share with them the magic of this fabulous gift that is unique to America. No other country has produced anything like jazz. And we're so proud of it, and we're so lucky, we think, the Mitchell-Ruff duo, to be in the position to take it around the world and to share it with other audiences, that we can never get enough of it.
I want to ask you a couple of things about your mother. You were pretty young when she died. You were 13.
Right.
She was
45.
And she really seemed, from reading your book, to be the kind of mother who was so dedicated,
yes,
to her family and to instilling in the children a sense of,
yes,
responsibility and the importance of education.
Mm-hmm.
And she died from tuberculosis.
Right.
She also seemed to be the kind of mother who really didn't want the children to know,
mm-hmm,
that she was physically threatened.
Right.
So how did you really comprehend the gravity of what was happening to her?
Well, at that time it was easy to comprehend, Terry, because tuberculosis, or a spot on the lungs, which was a nice way of putting it back then, was the kiss of death. Everybody knew it. It hasn't been eradicated. I understand it's on the rise again now, but in 1945, there was just very little hope for anyone who got a serious case of TB. They, in the South especially, they were going to die, and we knew. Right? I mean, nobody had to tell me that my mama was going to die and that she was dying. I could see it.
Did she have good medical help?
No. The hospitals were so intensely segregated there and in our area, they wouldn't touch a black person in her condition. So she had to go to a teaching hospital in Nashville, Meharry Medical School in Nashville, for treatment, and they finally sent her home to die.
How far was that from your home?
Oh, about 120 miles.
That's a long distance when you're not well.
That's right. That's a very long distance.
When your mother died, you went to live with your father in Indiana.
Right.
And your parents had been separated for a while.
Since I was just practically born.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So your mother was this kind of pillar of strength and responsibility from the way you describe her. What was your father like?
Well, my father wasn't a pillar of strength and responsibility. He tried hard, but he was a man who was very much affected by his world, and his world was a brutal one. He was damaged by it in spirit and ultimately in body, so that it was clear to me that I would not be able to thrive as a 13-year-old there, and that's why I chose the Army as my deliverance.
Did he know how to take care of you?
No. We lived together in a rented room, and I ate a couple of meals a day, the only meals I got, in restaurants around town. So I went in the Army mainly because I was hungry as a as they say down south, I had wrinkles in my belly. I thrived on GI food, all those good potatoes and all, grew like a weed.
Did your father expose you to things that would have been considered dangerous or improper for somebody of your age, but it was pretty interesting?
Yes, my father exposed me to jazz music. Oh, every chance he got, he'd take me out to grown folks' places where they were smoking and drinking and cussing and dancing nasty. I mean, really dirty dancing back then. And I could see these dance halls where expert, fabulous musicians in Evansville, Indiana, were playing the varnish off those horns. And it was just the most... That was the thing that he and I shared, this musical fascination with jazz music and the gift of the Black American spirit as expressed in music. That was our greatest common bond.
Do you practice your horn anymore?
Oh, Lord, do I ever practice. I spend my life with that thing. Almost sleep with it, eh? And I try to get it better and better and better all the time. I soothe it and call it pretty names. I call my horn Lena. Lena Horn. Because anybody with a name like that and a name of such a pretty woman has to behave.
How many horns do you have?
I have a spare, but it's nothing like Lena.
Is the place you're living in Alabama like a small town?
Oh, yes. I live out in the... I don't even live in a small town. I live out in the woods, way back out in the woods where the hoot owls court the chickens.
What do you like about living isolated like that?
Peace and quiet, and I can get up out of the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and practice the horn, and if anybody hears it, they are trespassing.
And it's their problem.
Right.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, again for the invitation.
Willie Ruff's autobiography, A Call to Assembly, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. This afternoon we have a piece from the Soviet Union on reaction to what Boris Yeltsin said over the weekend. The mayor of San Francisco, there's a new candidate in that race, a Chinese-American. We have a report on a cholera epidemic in Africa. It apparently is not as widespread as it is in South America, but more people are dying of it. Ethiopian refugee camps, situation there seems to be somewhat improved, especially for children. We have an interview with people who have walked all the way across America on the Discovery Trail. And we have a piece on Peter Benchley's new book. He wrote Jaws. This one's called Beast.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Yesterday's news reports highlighted the latest word from Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, his call for the Communist Party platform to abandon Marxist-Leninist doctrine and pay more attention to individual rights. Commentator David Gurevich, who emigrated to this country from Russia 15 years ago, compares the relative weight of such news in the Soviet and American press.
History works in odd ways. Only 6 years ago, the Soviet Union was the first country to start taking apart the house that Lenin built. Gorbachev was perceived as the leader in the movement away from communism. But then, bang, the wall came tumbling down. And now the poor Poles don't know what to do with the Stonehenge of Lenin monuments. Same goes for republics like Georgia, Moldova. Suddenly, Gorbachev is lagging behind. For sure, he keeps moving in the same direction, but boy, does he drag his feet. The funny thing to me is that each of his tiny half-steps gets so much play in our media. Only yesterday, the big story was the text of the speech he will deliver at the coming party conference. Well, things have changed. In the good old days, the speech would have been published by Pravda after the conference. Nowadays, the text gets leaked by someone, most likely Gorbachev himself, to the Independent paper. That's the actual name of the paper, by the way, and its editorial position is quite pro-Yeltsin. Gorbachev's brand new pronunciamentos were reported here with utter seriousness. I think I know when Peter Jennings is serious and when he's not. But what did the Soviet leader actually say? That, in his opinion, a party member can also believe in God and cross himself in public? that the principle of private property does not contradict the socialist system? You call that news? As far as I'm concerned, that's about as newsworthy as saying that this season the Cleveland Indians don't have much of a chance in the pennant race. Now, really, last week Yeltsin, as the president of the Russian Republic, prohibited party members from organizing at the workplace, like in offices and factories, which means, hey, you want to do party work? Do it on your own time and at your own expense. Which means no party meetings on state time and get off the telephone. That's business calls only. Now, that was a blow. No wonder Gorbachev's spokesman instantly denounced it as illegal. But American media has traditionally given more airplay to the head of state, any state, no matter how insignificant the event. And I do understand the feelings of many Americans who grew up used to the concept of a communist monolith. It takes time to digest the change, especially as radical as the downfall of an ideology that, for most of the century, has been a boogaboo for the West. But the change is real. Communism fell in the hearts and the minds of people long ago. Now its power structure is falling apart too, and there's absolutely nothing Gorbachev can do to prevent it from collapse. On a recent visit back to Moscow, I saw him in action during a parliamentary debate, which in Russia is shown on primetime TV. He's a brilliant tactician, and I'm sure that were he transplanted to this country, he would make a hell of a politician, a senator, for example. But he started out as so much more. He started as a truly historical figure. Oh, well, as they say in Southern California, he caught the wave. He just can't ride it. And that means he's headed for a wipeout.
David Gurevich is the author of the new memoir, From Lenin to Lenin, meaning from Vladimir to John. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. And our toll-free listener line is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Just about everyone who lives in a large city worries about crime. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about neighborhood town watch groups, people banding together to help protect themselves against theft and violence. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.